The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome from a rainy Washington, D.C., which perhaps symbolizes the gloom felt by congressional Democrats after a sweeping election on Tuesday brought Republicans to power in the House of Representatives and narrowed the scope of power that the Democrats have over the United States Senate. We're going to spend about half an hour on the show today talking about what those changes mean for you and your business and your life with a couple of experts, and then we're going to get into a little more detail on the future of transportation policy in this new Congress and also the future of foreign relations with the incoming Congress later in the show. But joining us now for the next half hour, we've got Daryl Nuremberg, the former deputy chairman of the Public Policy Department of Patton Boggs, and one of his colleagues, Vince Ferlicci, who's a former Democratic political operative. And Daryl and Vince, both veterans here of the show, so welcome back. And Daryl, as the victorious party, we'll start with you. Big picture, what happened and why on Tuesday?
Well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate the intro and also your having me on the show.
And I believe, apologies, but I think we also have Nick Allard, who's joining us live from London to talk about big picture issues as well. But go ahead, Daryl.
Well, there was something in here for both parties. So to say just the Republicans were victorious, I think overstates it. Obviously, was a good night for Republicans, especially in the House of Representatives. But let's focus for a second on why electorate turned out the way they did in the House and replaced some of the Democratic senators. And specifically, I think you've got two reasons. One is that I believe the Democrats misread the election of 2008 and saw a mandate there that wasn't there. They engaged quickly in dealing with a conflict in the House of Representatives as to the direction they should go. As you recall, after the 2008 election, Kevin, the House had leadership had two choices. Either they could heed the lessons of 1994 and look to spend their first 2 years protecting their members in weaker districts and trying to solidify their majority by taking a more moderate course, or they could look to take the opportunity of having a Democratic House, Senate, and White House to enact policies with the goal of fundamentally changing the direction of our country to the left, even with a risk to maintaining control afterwards. The leadership took the latter option and ended up spending their time enacting legislation which was well far to the left of the American public and which was not on point to what many, if not most, Americans are thinking about, which is the economy, high unemployment, and also the threat individuals have who have jobs of potentially losing their jobs or their income decline. So it was a message from the public that they've seen what happened the last 2 years. It's not what they want, and they voted on it at the booth.
And Vince, turning to you, and then we're going to come to Nick for an international perspective, but turning to you, Vince, what do you think the Democratic narrative was coming out of the election this week? Where did they feel like they lost this?
Well, I think that the views are divergent inside the party right now, and I think whenever there's a loss, the team in the locker room starts looking around and says, well, you know, you didn't do this or you didn't do that, so I can't say that there's one cohesive explanation inside the party about why all this happened. I do think taking off on what Daryl said, that the I think the fundamental mistake that was made, the leadership mistake that was made, was not realizing that when the president was elected 90 days after Lehman Brothers failed and the financial market was basically cratering, that his presidency needed to be about restoring the economy. And simply looking back to history and looking back at Franklin Roosevelt's first term, and while many progressives in the Democratic Party state all the different accomplishments he made on issues like creating Social Security, if you look historically, he didn't do anything in the first 2 years of his first term except restore the economy by creating the FDIC and getting the banking system going. It wasn't until the midterms had completed that he turned to social issues. So I think that that's the mistake that the administration and the leadership on the Hill and my party made, was to fixing social issues before fixing the economy.
Nick, are you with us now?
Yeah, mates. I'm over in England, and it's very interesting to see their take. It's a little bit of a yawn, surprisingly. Of course, they've been through their own tidal wave. The take on the headlines, the few that pay attention and lead with this story, is Obama humbled, which is kind of an interesting perspective. And, you know, they've seen it here before where, you know, say Churchill gets them through the Blitz, and just as about before the end of World War II, before final victory over the Germans, people turned him out incredibly, and he lost the prime ministership. So, you know, there's some irony, some parallels, but it's very interesting. And, you know, as a Democrat, I was contemplating just staying over here, but I remember that it's out of the frying pan and into the fire since the conservatives are in charge over here as well.
Well, I'm sure that there's somewhere that'll have you, Nick. I would start with the non-extradition countries myself if I were you, but perhaps you'll find somewhere. Let's hit some of the key races. Daryl, I think it's fair to say Republicans had a good day on the Senate side. You're a former chief of staff for a United States senator, a guy who did a lot of this strategy, but they didn't have the day they were capable of. So tell me what surprised you most about Republican performance in the Senate.
Well, I think the big surprise was one that should not have been a surprise, and that was Harry Reid succeeding in holding his seat. There was obviously a lot of discussion in the months leading up to the election, especially the last week, that saying he was on his way out. And that discussion was on both the Democratic and Republican side, but it greatly underestimates a few factors. One is Harry Reid has been in office in Nevada one way or another for a long time. He's had a long string of wins. He's had those wins with the situation being him not being personally popular. He had a very professional organization. And, you know, the post-op was on TV is that, you know, he's not a great candidate, but he had a great campaign. That's not right. He was a great candidate. He knew who he was. He knew how to play his strengths. Knew how to compensate for his weaknesses and ended up winning that race. So that was the big surprise. That shouldn't have been a surprise.
And Vince, on the Democratic side, Daryl actually just talked about a Democrat. Is there a race you feel got away from your party that was winnable?
No. I think the Republican Party kind of got them all. I think there are some that were surprises. But no, I don't.
Well, and Nick, let me toss it back to you. So I think of all the results, and there's still obviously a couple pending in Washington State and Alaska, one of the ones that surprised me the most was Wisconsin, where a three-term Democratic senator seemed to go down really quickly this summer and fall without much fanfare and without perhaps the sort of fireworks that a lot of the third-party entries, a lot of third-party advertising and other races brought to the national attention to those races. What happened to a Russ Feingold up there, and what's that mean about how Washington's changing?
Well, Wisconsin seemed to be changing, and you know, Russ is a good example of somebody who I think, like Rick Boucher, who's done a lot and certainly been responsible for some major pieces of legislation, who just caught the wave and was in the wrong people who are fed up with how they feel, you know, the way Washington works, you'd think that Russ would get some degree of credit for working with McCain and for campaign finance reform and so on. And, you know, he had this habit, this rigor of going and visiting every county, every one of his terms, every year. So he was back in the district a lot. It's not one of these people that after he succeeds, wasn't paying attention to home cooking. But there are, I mean, there's, when you see Rick Boucher losing or people like Ron Klein in Florida, who had been the state majority leader in the state of Florida, very capable person and voted as the star, you know, the rookie of the year when he was first elected 2 terms ago.
Nick, let me interject only because I think we're having a little bit of problem hearing you out there. And so let me transition back to Daryl for a minute while we work on your line from London. Daryl, the Nick's talking about Boucher being a surprise, Ron Klein down in Florida being a surprise. You have to be, as a Republican guy who's fairly in touch with the political scene and very engaged there, you have to be like me. You're looking at the webcast and the newscast Tuesday night, and you're saying to yourself, who are some of these guys who are winning these races out there?
Well, that's a good point, Kevin, and there has not been a lot of focus on that issue. You know, back here in Washington, there's been a lot of focus on the Senate races and the Tea Party influence there. Totally missed has been the influence of the Tea Party on in congressional races. In addition to a number of races where Democratic incumbents were beat by individuals who are associated with the Tea Party or inspired to run by Tea Party or the Tea Party philosophy, you also have to consider there are a number of open seats out there which were either Republican or Democratic held previously, where you had active primaries and the victor in those primaries would be someone who would be aligned with or associated with or adopts a policy of the Tea Party. So many of these individuals who are coming to Washington as freshmen are being inspired by the kind of limited government, low spending Tea Party philosophy, and will bring that here. They're coming here, Kevin, not necessarily to become a part of Washington. It's more that they want to change Washington.
Very good. And let me end with you, Vince. We've got about a minute left. Who were the biggest shockers out of the Democratic lines that lost sort of out of the blue Tuesday night in the House?
Well, I think Daryl and Nick would concur with me that watching watching chairmen of committees like Jim Oberstar from the Iron Range in Minnesota, the chairman of the Transportation Committee for many years, lose was shocking. To see John Spratt from South Carolina, the chairman of the Budget Committee, lose, another lion. And I think also Rick Boucher from Virginia, who was mentioned before, one of the most intelligent and thoughtful policymakers, someone who truly wanted to work on policy, right? And to see him lose, that was a real surprise. And I think overall on that, with looking at who the retirements as well came out of the Senate this term, I think that...
Let me interject here. Let's hold that for after the break and we can talk about big issues. We'll be back in just a minute to talk more fallout from the election.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202- 2-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big
trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball,
off the glass,
football,
come on,
golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody. We've got three guests talking about the outcome of the elections on Tuesday. We are joined by Darryl Nuremberg, a former head of the policy department at Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., and one of his colleagues, Vince Ferlicci, former Democratic political operative, and also Nick Allard, a former Democratic staffer who was also a former leader of the policy group at Patton Boggs, joining us from abroad. We may have him back on the line in just a minute. But well, we were off during the commercial break having a great discussion. And so, Vince, I want to circle back to one of the questions you raised, and that is, do you think Washington heard what the people were saying in the election on Tuesday night?
Well, I don't. And let me go first about my party. And my biggest critique about my party is that I don't think that we've heard the voters the last few years and focused on the economy. And for instance, I pulled up the data of the 50 markets in this country that have the most underwater homes in America. And it's stunning. If you look at where these homes are, it's exactly where this earthquake hit. It's Florida, Ohio, Illinois, Nevada, California. And that's if you look at these house races, it correlates very well. So my point is that when I heard in the last day that one of the first things Republicans might go and work on would be to try to repeal and replace health care reform, I just, I have concerns from my Republican friends saying, you know, hey, I think the message may have been more the economy, and is it possible that as much as maybe that needs to be done, that's not what the voters are asking for out of the gate. And so I just, I'm just wondering whether or not, you know, anyone, not just the president, sort of heard the message that came out of this election.
Darryl, I think it's terrific that Vince has concern for his Republican friends now that they're back in the majority.
Yeah, I appreciate the concern, and I hope that our leaders weren't listening, because I guess what the Democrats have missed is the negative impact that health care reform has had on the economy even before it's implemented. And I believe the Republicans are going to come in, and they're going to be focused on the economy, and that is going to mean something different than the traditional Democratic idea of sending out stimulus payments to keep state and government employees on the job. Instead, what you can see the Republicans are going to do, they're going to try to create some certainty in the area of taxation, because the uncertainty created and the threats of the Democrats not to renew the Bush tax levels have forced businesses and individuals to hold back on spending and investing. The second thing you could see Republicans looking at is health care reform, because the onerous regulations that are envisioned in health care reform are deterring companies from taking the risk they need to in order to expand and create jobs. And then the third thing you'll look for the Republicans to do is hit something that is largely a large concern of the public, and that is the size of the federal government and the amount of money that we spend on it. The American public know that the size of the government is a direct impediment to growing our economy and the free enterprise system.
Very interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the issues you think we're, Darrell, let's delve into this a little bit further. Republicans, John Boehner about to be the speaker, and Eric Cantor has sort of come out of the gate running for the majority leader and offering a detailed plan of what he thinks Republicans will do. Energy, health care, tax, trade, spending, those are all big issues. Talk to us about how you prioritize those, and do you do things that you know can't pass the Senate or won't be signed by the president, or do you try and do first the things that you know have a chance of getting to the president's desk and becoming law?
Well, Kev, let me give a maybe a little bit more broad overview on where the Republicans stand taking the House and increasing their numbers in the Senate. And the first thing is there's obviously comparisons drawn between now and 1994, but it's important to remember that there are significant differences between today and 1994, which leave the Republicans in a much better position to legislate and use Congress as a platform than they did last time. Second point is that although Tea Party candidates for the Senate did not succeed in the numbers that had been originally projected or effectively feared by the Democrats, the positions that the Tea Party movement has adopted will heavily influence the policy of Republicans. Third is that the policy directions that the Republicans are going to pursue are better defined in advance now than they were back in 1994. And last but not least, something you touched upon, Kevin, is that there's major legislation that Congress is going to need to look at. And so their ability of Republicans to impact the direction of that legislation is going to be significant. In terms of what's different this versus last time, is that, remember, Kevin, is that the Republicans have a lot more experience in governing than they did in 1995. In 1995, when they took the House, it had been a generation before the Republicans, since the Republicans had held the House. Many of the Republicans in leadership and in the institution were here during the time the Republicans were in control and have that basis of knowledge and experience. Second is that, unlike 95, we can expect much better coordination between the House and Senate Republican leadership. Senator McConnell and Congressman or Speaker-to-be Boehner have good communications. They had during the time when the Democrats controlled both houses, and there's every reason to believe that there'll be more coordination between the two parties. And third is that the Republicans have a much more clearly defined agenda, as I had just discussed about.
So let me bring Vince in here. So Vince, Darrell's got the plan sort of locked and loaded for the Republicans in the House. Harry Reid's coming back to town, very happy to be reelected, but discovering that he's got six less votes in his pocket than he did on most issues of the day the last 18 months or so since Specter flipped parties. How does that change the Democratic agenda? What do you think they hope to accomplish in the Senate the next 2 years?
I think that's a real open question right now. I think the first thing that they're going to have to do is to respond to the administration's plan on GSE reform and Fannie and Freddie, not to go back to housing again, but that's sort of the next economic thing that they're going to want to deal with. First of all, they need to deal with the tax issue. I think the interesting thing, playing off of what Darrell just said, is if the Republicans are as organized and have a skill set that's unique and not 94, and they will do a better job, then I think if that's the case, then I would predict that the Obama administration may use a form of triangulation a little bit like 1994, but the person who will be triangulated that would be Harry Reid. And then the question is that how is that relationship between the president and the speaker, and is the Speaker Boehner, and is Speaker Boehner able to create a productive message to really take advantage of what will be an overwhelming control, more than likely, from the Senate and maybe even the White House in 2012?
Very interesting. Boehner and Obama, my prediction is they'll play golf somewhere before the end of the year, since they're both big golf guys, and that could be a way for them to bond. You know, one of the other things we talked about during the break, Daryl, I want to get your thoughts on, is Vince's contention that Republicans really left some seats on the table and that that could come back to haunt them. I'm more interested in what that means about the battle inside the Republican caucus between Jim DeMint, who was out sort of taking a victory lap yesterday on behalf of the Tea Partiers, and your more establishment Republicans inside the Senate conference there.
Well, that's an interesting question. It's a question of the day. You know, talk about the three seats left on the table. Obviously, you're referring to Delaware, Nevada, and Colorado, where the conventional wisdom is that if Morris, if the candidates associated with the Republican establishment had been nominated, then those would have been Republican seats. And that may have been the case in Delaware. I can't speak to Colorado. I'm not sure that's the case in Nevada, because that theory greatly underestimates Harry Reid's skill. But Mitch McConnell does have a challenge going forward, is dealing with disparate interests among his senators. But any leader at any time has that challenge, because each senator, and it was designed this way by the founding fathers, is an entity of up among him or herself, and that they have their own way of thinking, and it may not necessarily coincide with the majority in their caucus. A couple things to keep in mind, though, Kevin, is that even though you didn't have all the Tea Party candidates running for the Senate win, the Tea Party will have influence over most Republicans. First, because you have Tea Party members who are now joining as freshmen, but also because Republicans who are up for re-election, the one thing they don't want to do is see themselves challenged in a primary from the right. Members do not like primaries. And so they'll be looking at the Tea Party agenda to try to cover their bases and secure their position for a future election. So the divisions within the caucus are always there, but it may not be as great as has been projected by the talking heads here in town.
I got about 2 minutes left, so real fast, I'm going to put you on the spot for 2 years from now, both of you guys. Who wins the House and Senate in 2012, and does Tuesday's results mean that Barack Obama will get reelected, true or false? We'll start with you, Vince.
I think in 2012, the Republicans take the Senate, and Barack Obama narrowly gets reelected.
Republicans keep the House in that instance?
Republicans keep the House. Now, listen, if Obama's reelected, it'll create a Democratic draft, theoretically, for the House. But because of what happened with 17 state legislative chambers flipping from D to R, you're going to have a huge redistricting advantage for Republicans. So the seats that were fought over on Tuesday will not be the seats in 2012. Be brand new drawn seats. The Republicans are going to hold the House for quite a while. They're going to get the Senate in 2012. I'm saying the president wins re-election because in history, you know, the president who's taken over for a president of an opposition party who served two terms has always won re-election, except for one, and it was Jimmy Carter. Now, he could be Jimmy Carter, but I'm going to go with history on this one.
Great point. Daryl, what do you think?
Republican keeps the House, same reasons Vince mentioned, also because of the large margin. Republicans take the Senate, although I don't think that's a guarantee. Obviously, the reason to think they will is because there are significantly more Democratic seats up for re-election next time than this time. Also layer into that factor Vince didn't mention is that we could expect retirements from Democrats in the House who don't like the fact they're not in the majority, and potentially retirements among Democrats in the Senate, because a number of the Democrats up are very senior in terms of seniority and age. In terms of the presidency, obviously it's wide open right now. There's a vacuum, and it's going to be a wild race. I hope the economy is in such a situation that that is not a factor in hurting Obama. I hope that the economy gets better, and it's because government has worked. But I think it's much too early to determine whether he will be reelected. A lot depends on the actions he takes in the wake of this election.
Very good. Well, everybody sees a Republican Washington in Congress in 2 years. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about transportation.
Whether the
the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We had a fascinating 30-minute discussion with a couple of political junkies about what the election meant, what it will mean for the next 2 years in Washington. We're going to delve in a little deeper in a couple of subject areas on that now, one of which is with Norma Kraham, again, one of my colleagues from Patton Boggs, who happens to have a great deal of experience in the transportation sector, having served as Rodney Slater, then the Secretary of Transportation, as his Deputy Chief of Staff during the Clinton administration and now in the private sector for several years. Norma, welcome back, and I know that you probably didn't win any office pools based on the projections of results on Tuesday, but you have a lot to share with us about what those results meant. And I guess the biggest sort of change, biggest question is, what the heck happened to Transportation and Infrastructure Chairman Jim Oberstar of Minnesota, who loses somewhat out of the blue?
Thank you, Kevin, and it's great to be back on. You know, what's interesting is, you're right, maybe I didn't win any of the pools, but I lived through the 1994 Newt Gingrich revolution, and I think a lot of folks saw this coming. What's really interesting, though, for Chairman Oberstar, I don't think any of us saw that coming. It's clear that there was a perfect storm of voter discontent, anger, and frustration, all of which is understandable in this economy, but Chairman Oberstar has always been one to take care of his district and to take care of his constituents. So, honestly, the election night when we saw him, he was up by a hair, and we thought he was going to make it, and then the next morning, we were just shell-shocked.
Well, so, but it wasn't just Oberstar. I did sort of a quick count yesterday for somebody. By my count, there's 45 Democrats on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee in the House of Representatives. By my count, I think 16 or 17 of them lost, including virtually the whole junior third of the panel. So what does that mean about the future of of a committee that's got some fairly significant work the next couple of years?
You know, I think it's going to be an interesting dynamic. Unfortunately, a lot of the, especially the younger, newer members on the committee, some of those folks were in seats that we had taken back from the Republicans, and it was going to be very hard to keep them no matter. What I'm hoping is with the committee at this point, we expect Chairman Micah, Congressman Micah to come in as the chairman. It has always been a very bipartisan approach. I do think that most people understand and realize that transportation is really an economic, it's not just economic creator, it's a job creator, but it's really the foundation of our economy and how we can get it moving, no pun intended. So I think we're going to have to make sure that the folks who are on the panel understand the core importance. And it's not just about big spending. It's about making sure that the U.S. remains competitive as a nation.
Well, let's talk about Micah. So he's a congressman from the Orlando area, and this is a committee that's traditionally not been as hyper-partisan as some of the other House committees. So tell us what you think his philosophy will be with, again, an FAA bill pending, a highway and transportation reauthorization sort of waiting to get to the finish line, some other key issues like cargo security popping up on our radar screen the last couple of weeks with those terrorism threats. How does John Micah take control? What do you see him doing?
You know, I'll tell you that it gives us some comfort to know Mr. Micah will be the incoming chair. We worked with him for many, many years. He's been a consistent voice. He actually came out with a statement, I think it was just the other day, that reiterated how important he thinks that trying to move reauthorization, safety lou reauthorization, FAA reauthorization, even looking at the WERDA reauthorization and maybe a long-term Coast Guard bill, he's on top of his issues. I think he will lead the committee in the way that it needs to be led, and we'll carry on a bit of Mr. Oberstar's vision. I think he's going to have to decide how best to work with Republican leadership to move these bills and to frame them not as pork. If you asked anybody if they want to pay more in user fees right now, they might say no. But if you said the bridge over the Groton New London Bridge in Connecticut is falling down, and I know you use that bridge to get to work, would you pay a little bit more to fix the bridge? People would say yes. So I think we need to put a better face on transportation so people understand what it's all about.
Yeah, very interesting. What happens in the lame duck? I know that, you know, the president's been talking about trying to get $50 billion in new spending pushed through during the lame duck. Is there any chance that happens given this turnover?
Honestly, I think it's very difficult for even the outgoing Congress to move a $50 billion bill. There's a lot of discussion, whether it's the talking heads or the voters themselves, about dissatisfaction with where things are. I simply can't see even members who unfortunately lost their elections coming back and trying to move a bill like that. And I think the incoming Republican leadership knows that they need to work with their respective new colleagues, some of the Tea Party folks, to help them understand why these issues are important. I just don't see any way you can push $50 billion through in, what, a couple weeks?
Yeah, it seems unlikely. Well, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about Homeland Security. We talked about Oberstar. What sort of changes are coming House and Senate side on the Homeland Security oversight panels?
Sure. You know, I think consistent with the fact that we have familiar faces on the transportation committees, we have the same situation on the House Homeland Security and then the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Peter King, who's a congressman from New York, we expect to be coming back in as the chair of the committee. Mr. Thompson, who had been the chairman, will be the ranking member. I think you're going to see a lot of focus in the next really few months and next year on really what's happened in what will be the 10 years since 9/11. The 10th anniversary is coming up next year. And I think Peter King and many of the members of the committee are very concerned because of incidents that we've seen in the last few weeks. You've had the air cargo bombs. You've had the threats against the Washington, D.C. metro system. It's hard to believe. We had the Christmas Day potential bomber and then the New York Times bomber. I think you're going to see a hard focus on where we are and tremendous oversight.
Yeah, there's lots of concerns about these air cargo bombs. Also, seems like transit systems are being targeted. There was an arrest here by the FBI a week or two ago with a potential threat against the metro system. What can Congress reasonably do about those things? I mean, it's hard to balance security with my need to make it to the 812 Orange Line train downtown.
Sure. A couple things. First, transit has always been an area of concern, transit and rail, for folks in the Congress and in the administration, no matter really who's in charge. It's hard to figure out how to manage ensuring that you can get to where you need to be on time and add additional security. And transit and Amtrak, those are harder systems to secure, if you will, and keep people moving, and I think that's a big issue. A lot has been done since 9/11. More needs to be done, but I think there is going to be an interesting juxtaposition of how do you, quote, add more security and make sure that you're doing it in a balanced budget environment. There have been some of the members of the Tea Party and others who have said, you know, we need to cut or hold the line in many areas, but Homeland Security is one area that we need to do what we need to do. Air cargo security, look, the 9/11 Implementation Act really worked well. It mandated that all inbound cargo on passenger aircraft be screened, but there actually is a vulnerability that the terrorists attempted to exploit. There is no mandate on screening of all air cargo planes coming into the U.S. So I think you're going to look at additional legislation and maybe regulation in that area. And there's a number of other issues, but I don't want to go too far just yet.
Sure. And, besides terrorism, I guess I've got about 3 minutes left, so tell me your other hot issues here besides terrorism in the Homeland Security area.
Sure. First thing, border security. There's been a lot of discussion and debate already. Border security becomes what I think is the lowest common denominator that can be defined as success.
Because yeah, Republicans will be hot on that issue in the House.
They're going to be hot on that issue. Immigration becomes part of that debate, but I think you can get folks to agree on border security. Cybersecurity is a huge issue. Before, the big focus was securing physical assets. If you're a terrorist, nation state, or a criminal, the way to get it, really the heart of America, is through cybersecurity. So there's legislation pending. The Obama administration and DHS are working on those issues in a very focused way, but we're going to see a lot more of that. Cargo port security, you know, first responder issues, some of those are pretty consistent areas of concern.
Gotcha. Norma, anything else that surprised you sort of that impacts the transportation and homeland security sector in terms of who won or lost or even what the president might be able to maneuver on these issues as a result of Tuesday?
You know, one of the big changes, you mentioned all the members on the T&I committee who lost. You've got a number of members on the House Homeland Security Committee who did lose elections or were running for other issues. So you're going to see fresh blood in both areas, and it will be interesting if you get perhaps some more conservative members, Tea Party folks, to see what their vision of securing the homeland is. I think it's going to be very challenging, and you need the funding to go with it. So we'll see how they balance some of those issues about cut, 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 and still maintain some of the issue areas that we need to on the security side.
Yeah, I had read somewhere that Republicans in the Senate had actually sent a letter to the Department of Justice asking them how much money they would need to actually enforce all the immigration laws on the books, including deporting illegals as they are brought into contact with law enforcement officials.
It's a big issue. Customs and Border Protection, also at DHS, they need more money for border agents. Again, so I think they're going to have to balance that out and then honestly have to be able to say in a talking point back to the American people why they wanted to cut one area and thought it was good to increase funding in another area. I think they can do it, but it's just about making sure that they understand the balance.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how the president and the Republicans newly placed in the majority treat transportation and infrastructure investment as an opportunity to help grow the economy or simply another spending line item to haggle over here in the next couple of years. Well, we're going to wrap things up there. We've been joined by Norma Kraham, former DOT senior official, now at Patton Boggs, to talk about transportation sector. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about international affairs in the wake of this election.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street
to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, we'll wrap up talking a little bit about some interesting situations involving Congress, perhaps in the lame duck or in the new Congress, and that is the involvement of a major settlement between the United States government and Native Americans. And joining us to talk about that is one of the attorneys very involved in that, Anu Varma here in Washington, D.C. Anu, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about the case that Native Americans had as a class against the United States government.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. About 11 years ago, Native American farmers and ranchers filed a lending discrimination case against the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Their claims went all the way back two decades, and the assertion was that in the implementation of our country's federal farm loan programs, that local loan officers, so federal employees working at the local county level, were not giving out loans based upon merit, but rather using their discretion to give it to their friends and neighbors, but not to Native American farmers and ranchers. That case was brought to federal court in 99, and after 11 years of hard litigation, we were able to reach a settlement with the U.S. Department of Agriculture just 2 weeks ago.
I'm here 11 years later. That's a scary thought that takes that long to get where you want to go. Now, Anu, I know you've been pretty engaged in a similar case involving African-American farmers. Tell me how this relates. That case has gotten a ton of press. The gentleman who heads that group, I think his name, John Boyd Jr., has done a great job in terms of driving his tractor to Washington, D.C. to attract media attention to the cause over the years. But how do these interrelate?
That's a great question. The African American farmers case was actually the first case brought in 1997. I was counsel on that case as well, and we settled that case for $1 billion in 1999. And it alleged the same type of lending discrimination, but in different parts of the country. And the reason why you have two different cases that are so similar is because it's the discretion that was given at the local county level to making loans and the abuse of that discretion, and then on top of that, no checks and balances from head office in Washington that was applied to both. Well, the first black farmers case settled, and several years later, a number of black farmers came forward and said, well, we didn't know about it, and now the case is closed. That's not fair. So Congress created a new right, basically a new cause of action to be brought in federal court, and that was filed in federal court in Washington. The string that's attached to the African-American farmers, the second case, is that any funds that go to that case have to be appropriated by Congress. That's not a limitation that's in the Native American farmers case, because that was just a straight lawsuit, but in this what you're reading in the newspapers and what we're fighting for every day is for Congress to approve it so that justice can actually just complete itself through the second African-American farmers case.
Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about the details of the settlement in terms of if I'm a class member, a Native American that was impacted here, a farmer or a rancher, what's it do for me and for this cause in general?
Sure. One of the problems that we have here is that Native American farmers and ranchers, that this case goes back to 1981. So it's 2010. So some of these cases are going to claims of discrimination go back 29 years. So documentation is very difficult. The agency did a very poor job. What we've set
no
up here,
emails from 1981.
No emails from 1981. What we've set up here is a process, a way for Native American farmers and ranchers to present claims, an opportunity to be heard. And what they do is they fill out a claim form, and we, the lawyers, will help them all over the country. And this form will describe what they went through. And then it'll be held up by a neutral third party, a group of retired lawyers and judges, who will basically look for the markings of credibility, and this whole process gives the benefit of the doubt to the farmer or rancher, and if they prevail, they'll get a cash payment, they'll get their federal farm loan debt wiped out, and probably the most important thing, current Native American farmers and ranchers and future Native American farmers and ranchers will have a host of benefits and changes to the system which have been negotiated into the agreement. And these changes to the system are specific measures that have been taken to increase the number of Native American farmers and ranchers that enter into this profession going forward.
So I got a claim going back into the 1980s. And we've won this case. You know, let's say my claim was worth $25,000 in 1985. Is that somehow indexed for inflation or to take account for the fact that I've been waiting for justice for a quarter century?
Yeah, for most people, the answer is no. What we try to do is, first of all, that would require expert testimony, and that would require a way to show exact numbers. We've decided to take an approach that we call liquidated damages, that if you were harmed, you just get a payment. Here you go. In the African-American farmer's case, that payment was $62,500, which is probably the largest single payment in a class action case that you'll ever see. This case, the payments are going to be similar. This is a closed fund, so it'll all depend on how many people come forward. But for the vast majority of people, you come in and you just fill out the paper, and the paper is an affidavit, and that's your proof right there, and you'll get a payment probably in the area of tens of thousands of dollars and your debt wiped out. For a very small number of people who believe they actually have documentary evidence of what they went through, there will be a separate process. From our experience in the African-American farmers case, that'll be a really small number. And those folks can get actual damages up to $250,000.
Gotcha. And then there's protections going forward to make sure that, you know, as a taxpayer paying now for this past discrimination, I guess I can understand. I'd be more concerned about making sure that I don't pay for it twice by having it continue to happen at the federal level.
That's exactly right, Kevin. What we have done is we've set up a council on Native American farming and ranching, This council will involve experts in Native American farming and ranching. It'll include farmers and ranchers, and it'll include people that the Secretary of Agriculture designates. As you know, many Native Americans live on reservations where the issue of the land that they hold and what they can pledge as collateral, the rules for all of that differ and that are uniquely part of the Native American experience. And when the rules on loan making don't mesh with the practice and procedures on Native American reservations, you got to have people there to make the pieces fit so that everybody gets a fair shake. That hadn't been happening for decades, and now it will happen because you'll have a collaborative effort to make sure it does happen.
Very good. Well, we've been joined by Anu Varma, who's walking us through the intricacies of two very complex cases involving Native American farmers and African American farmers who are getting past discrimination claims settled against the United States government here in the near future, and who's been very involved in that case for a number of years, probably longer than he would like for me to mention. We've had a great show talking about the fallout from the election. We'll be sure to discuss that in more detail. Next week, we'll have a substitute. Mike Dino will be in the house for me while I'm on travel, and he'll be talking about more issues related to the election. Until then, have a great weekend and come back next Thursday for more on Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.